I'm going to live to 400 or whatever, or longevity escape velocity. He's just like, I'm really interested in being able to run in my 90s.
Hello, and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. I am Rory, I do the podcasting, and I'm joined with Robert Morris, who does everything else.
How you doing today, Rory?
I'm doing very well. I've heard that you're off for a little holiday, is that true?
I am. It is my big trip for the year. I am heading to Southeast Asia for the first time, which I'm very excited about.
Any parts in particular? Are you doing a broad remit?
So far, Cambodia for sure.
Wow.
And then I am meant to go to an island off of Thailand, where I will be joining some friends at a Muay Thai gym, which is not really... I've tried doing the kickboxing before, but it is not something I'm particularly good at, so I'm not sure how long that'll last, and then perhaps I'll...
As long as you're not the bag, it should be okay.
Yeah, here's hoping. I do know that I'm going to be sweating. It is apparently just 90 degrees all the time there, so...
Well, yeah. What's America's relationship with Thailand?
Oh, I think it's generally pretty positive.
Okay, that's all right. It's not like lice or something?
No. One of the embarrassing things is I just don't know much about Southeast Asia. It is
a fascinating place. I think the most obvious country that everyone forgets is Indonesia.
Well, that's the fourth most populous country in the world,
yes.
I think.
Yes. And also, yeah. I know it's not if you add up all the land masses, but its breadth is immense.
Fascinating, just for my mental models, and perhaps this is just an illustration of my ignorance. I was like, wow, I can get from... Thailand to Cambodia to Vietnam really easily. These are all quick jump flights. So I was like, well, why don't I look into going to like Indonesia? And it was like, oh, and then that's 6 hours, you know?
Yes.
It's just like things sometimes seem close together, so sometimes seem rather far apart. But it's a fascinating region, and especially seeing as how I am writing a book on the U.S. Empire, there were a number of decades there, where the United States was quite involved in Southeast Asia.
Particularly in the Philippines?
Well, Vietnam.
And Vietnam, sadly.
Yes, that would be the main...
It also decided just to bomb Laos because it was too near these other countries.
Yes, that was a pity. But thankfully, it's with some exceptions, chiefly Burma, it is largely at peace now, and I'm excited to... get a bit of a sense of that part of the world.
Are you hoping to live longer so you can spend more time on holiday?
Yes, 100%. Excellent segue. what I would like to talk about today is something I have spent surprisingly little time talking about on the channel, but I am a long-term big nerd when it comes to longevity.
Okay.
The whole science and mythos around living longer. I've just always been kind of obsessed with this idea of living forever, which is kind of interesting. Like I was really, really, really into it in my 20s, to the point where I used to every day check the list of the oldest living human people. And it was very, very interesting.
Usually that's the age where you think you'll live forever and don't care.
Yeah, and it's funny because I'm in my 40s, which is the point at which more and more of my friends are just sort of like, oh, wow, how do I desperately rage against the dying of the light athletically, start really, really thinking about it. And I'm a little more blasé than I used to be. But I thought it was worth discussing because it is an ongoing fascination of mine, and I have, it is not an obsession the way it was in my 20s, but, I read a couple books on it every year. I try to keep apprised of what's developing. I take the recommended supplements, though I have a hunch that most of them are kind of snake oil.
Are you drinking enough cups of gravy?
Oh, is that what you're supposed to do? You drink cups of gravy? Is that
it's a little Simpsons reference.
Is that, that's right here. It's my cup of gravy right here, obviously. Uh-huh.
Rob has lifted a smoothie to the camera.
Yeah, indeed.
You're not into any of this, like cryo or anything like that?
No, I am not into cryo. I'm not into cryo. I'm not in the whole idea of downloading consciousness.
That doesn't make sense to me.
But what is very interesting about this era, and I think is perhaps something that I can add to discussions of longevity beyond like, gee, isn't it neat, the idea of living forever, is that I've been really interested in this for a while. So it's possible to talk about the fascinations, the predictions, the confident assertions of 20 years ago and sort of what's happening to them now. Really nothing more melancholy than someone who thought they were going to live forever and spent a lot of time preaching and agitating for that, who does not.
Well, there is good news in that sense, because there's like a kind of like, I don't know if you call it a lag or a bounce, but it's sort of like someone in their 40s will probably, you know, need, you know, a big medical intervention, say in your 80s. So that's still another good 40 years of development that you can expect to see. While if someone is in their 80s, the, you know, I'm going to live to 1,000 probably is going to miss them. So you still have a good couple of decades to hope for, you know, massive breakthroughs.
So the thing is, over the past 20 years, like, I absolutely have seen breakthroughs. But what's interesting is just sort of realizing that I'm certainly not going to live forever, which is clearer in when one's looking into these things in their 40s than it is when looking into these things in one's 20s. So I've read two books this year. One is Outlive by Peter Attia, which is fascinating. And I think this is a guy who's about my age, or maybe 5 to 10 years older.
Well, he's
older.
50.
He's 50. So yeah, 5 to 10 years older. So he's like clearly gone on more or less the same journey that I've been on, just infinitely more intense, because this guy's a medical doctor. This guy really has dived in. And it's kind of interesting that he's still cautiously optimistic. But he's not talking about, oh, I'm going to live to, you know, 400 or whatever, or talking about, you know, longevity, escape velocity. He's just like, I'm really interested in being able to run in my 90s, you know, like that, like much more
tangible.
Yes, much more tangible, much more humble. It's a good book to read, and it's kind of fascinating because he's a guy who has become disillusioned, clearly. He doesn't come right out and say it. Oh, he does maybe in a few instances, but it's clear that he's been somewhat disillusioned by the same thing that I've been a bit disillusioned by, which is spending decades being very interested in this, yet he's still reasonably optimistic.
Well, I think he's talking about something that sort of the NHS is criticized for specifically in its current form, which is that it's not there for health, it's there for sickness. So they kind of wait till something's gone wrong, you've got heart disease or diabetes, and then they try to fix it. Well, he seems to be more sort of preventative, as in, do these things to live healthy, and then you'll live longer and not have these issues.
No, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure.
Exactly.
Is the old saying. But it's interesting contrasting this Peter Attia book with this other book that I'm reading that unfortunately, I cannot tell you the name of the author. It's not in front of me.
De Grey?
No, I haven't read. I have not read any books by Aubrey de Grey, though he's a fascinating figure we can talk about. He actually wrote the introduction to this book, which is called Muerte de la Muerte. I'm reading it's in Spanish, and I'm just trying to read books in Spanish more. And so it's just interesting.
To help with your trip to Southeast Asia?
Obviously. It's a kind of book I haven't read in a little while. It's just a full-on, like, boosterism. It is like the kind of stuff I read that I got very excited about in my 20s, which is like, you know, the first person who's going to live to 1,000 years old is already alive today. I'm not saying that's impossible, but it's unlikely.
I'm
not going to put any money on it. But he's just filled with it. And it's just this, and it makes sense. I mean, this is how you get people interested in a topic that people, I believe, should be interested in. I do think that human beings can and should live longer. I do believe that there should be more research money put into it. Like, say, half the money we put into the Pentagon could probably be put into aging.
Yes, that would be outstanding.
Yeah, anti-aging
like
medicine.
Like skunkwork stuff that actually, you know, prolongs life as opposed to shortening some Muslims usually.
Yes.
On the other side of the world.
Yeah. That'd be nice. So I'm not saying that I'm at all against this. I just do have to say that after 20 years of being around this, being a somewhat educated layman on this, I'm here to tell you that things are not going to go as fast as you would like. Are you familiar with a figure named Ray Kurzweil?
Ray Kurzweil, no.
Fascinating. So do you know the concept of the singularity?
No. Explain to me.
So this is basically one of the great descriptions is the rapture for nerds.
Okay.
And this is the idea that, you know, extrapolating from Moore's law, the idea that, you know, computing just gets exponentially better and it has, you know, it's going to eat, you know, more and more of the rest of society, and it's going to, and that eventually at some point, Ray Kurzweil is a fabulously talented engineer who has spent the last couple decades predicting that at some point in the 2020s, or maybe it's the 2030s, I don't know where the date is.
So in 25 years, these technologies will be a billion times more powerful than they are today.
The rapid technological advancement is just going to get so fast that we're going to reach the singularity, and we're all just going to, all of a sudden, we're going to be gods that live forever.
Oh, yes.
That can decide to do whatever
normally
we want to do.
The singularity is referred to as like an AI thing. That's a bad thing. It becomes super self-aware, and then that's when we're all dead.
Oh, that's interesting, because that's a recent thing. I mean, as with everything about the internet, the way of looking at things has gotten a lot more negative. But circa, I think, The Singularity is Near was the name of Kurzweil's big book that made a big impact. And I think that came out in the 2007 or thereabouts. And as ever, you know, we talked about a Cory Doctorow book, who's this guy who was previously a big internet booster. And now he's like, we've got to break up all the big tech companies. Everybody's gotten a little more negative with time on this dynamic. But in 2007 or thereabouts, you know, in the 2000s, we were still like, the internet is bringing nothing but positivity, and we're about to go launching into heaven on earth, utopia. And yes, Ray Kurzweil would also emphasize that this could all go wrong. We're going to create these machine intelligences. But this was always wrapped up as sort of like an ancillary thing, like for Ray Kurzweil as being part of that, being that we're all going to live forever. And this is kind of a baby boomer thing. So Ray Kurzweil is now 76 years old, and I wish him the best of luck. And I think that, you know, it is interesting looking at, there's another guy I was looking at recently who wrote this series of books called Younger Next Year, which is about, it's actually similar to Outlive. It's sort of talking about basic interventions that you can do to guarantee that you live longer. And he's in his 90s, so, you know, he's doing pretty well. There is going to come a point, not too distant, where a lot of the advocates and the stars of anti-aging from 20 years ago are going to start dying, and that is just that's an interesting dynamic. I guess Peter Diamandis, he's only 62 years old, so, you know, he could be around for four decades or whatnot, and it's I don't know. I just thought that was worth noticing, because it's profoundly melancholy, but it is kind of interesting, because despite how jaded perhaps I've gotten on this topic, I do believe that these men who have perhaps, and they do seem to mostly be men, it does seem that this is largely a baby boomer male pursuit, this idea of living forever.
But is it a bit like nuclear fusion in the sense that, oh, there'll be a breakthrough in the next 10 years and then we'll all live forever?
Yeah. It's perpetually. I think it's so, what people got incredibly excited about was the Human Genome Project in the 1990s. We're like, oh, we're going to figure out everything. And then we're just going to, you know, there'd just be a pill you'll pop and then boom. And I think what happened was, and it was incredibly exciting, because this is exactly the sort of thing that Ray Kurzweil was talking about. You know, the Human Genome Project, like doing 1% of it took 5 years, and then doing 10% of it took 10 years. And then it exponentially got faster. And all of a sudden, like the deadline that nobody thought we were going to meet, we met, because there were breakthroughs and it worked and da da da. And then we saw it, we had the information, and then we were like, we have no idea what this map means and where it leads and what could this possibly, and absolutely, because of the sequencing of the human genome, that initial reading of the map that happened all the way back around the turn of the century.
Dolly the sheep?
Yes, there you are, Dolly the sheep. But because of that incredible scientific achievement, we are getting tremendous breakthroughs. You know, cancer treatment has been revolutionized.
Because you were talking about a treatment that Jimmy Carter went through.
Sure, immunology, the sort of science of getting our immune systems to recognize cancer, because that was the thing that made cancer so terrible was that our body didn't recognize that it was a disease. And for certain kinds of cancers, for tantalizingly, frustratingly few, but for some cancers, immunology has provided a magic bullet. But all of these, the progress is absolutely happening. The breakthroughs are happening, but they are so much slower than promised. And they are not going to come in time to save all of these people. I mean, who knows? Ray Kurzweil is 76. He's apparently apparently had type 2 diabetes and cured himself.
Okay,
which
interesting.
Is pretty extraordinary. So he essentially fixed his whatever system through diet.
But it is still anecdotal evidence.
Very, very anecdotal. But he's also a very wealthy man who has put incredible thought and time into his health for decades. So it's entirely within the realm of imagining that he will live another quarter century. And if he does live another quarter century, then I do believe that in 25 years, there will be something that'll keep him going for another five.
But there's this darker side to this that I'm aware of that seems to happen, particularly in America, which is, say you get to 90 and you've lived a long 90 years, but at 90, realistically, you should die. But say you're wealthy. The American insurance companies are like, we could squeeze a bit more out of him. So what's apparently is currently happening is you'll have incredibly old people that are wealthy and they'll keep them alive for another 5 years. But that 5 years is just horrendous pain and suffering. So they can just eke out. So technically, yeah, you lived another 5 years, but it wasn't worth living.
I mean, that's the great debate. And I think more and more people are becoming conscious. And I think it was great of reading. So this Spanish language book is very uncritically boosterish about like, oh, we're going to just a few years from now, we're all going to live forever or what have you. But it the doctor of these, there's this incredible family of brothers. Have you heard of Rahm Emanuel? Does that ring a bell? So he was famously mocked on Saturday Night Live during he was, I think, Obama's first chief of staff. He's a very abrasive politician from Chicago. Andy Samberg used to play him as like a just very foul-mouthed, like street thug, like as Obama's. Anyway, regardless, he's an interesting figure. I think is currently, or at least was for a while, the ambassador to Japan, which seemed like a terrible mismatch. Anyway, Rahm Emanuel, famous politician. I believe it's one of his brothers is a famous, Ari Emanuel is the inspiration for Jeremy Piven's character on Entourage, is actually a famous Hollywood guy. And then the third brother is a famous doctor, also played political role around Obamacare, being the brother of Rahm Emanuel. Anyway, his intervention on this was basically he had a big article a number of years back that I did not read, but I have now mostly read in Spanish because this book has very over-reliant on excerpts, but is a fascinating argument, which is just what this guy, Zeke Emanuel, has declared is that
what I don't want to do is say take chemotherapy if I got cancer at that point.
After the age of 75, he's simply not going to seek any treatment for diseases. He says if he breaks an arm or if there's something that he'll get that dealt with. But he says if he gets cancer, he's just going to go with it. If he gets he is not interested in prolonging his life for exactly that reason, that reason you're talking about. It is a fascinating argument. And one of the things that I found most fascinating, which also dovetails kind of interestingly with the priorities of a lot of these longevity advocates over the past 20 years, is he's saying, because we've had so much success against heart disease, because we've had so much success against certain kinds of cancer, we've actually gotten to the point where more of the percent, it was something like of the people in their 80s, a higher percentage is now debilitated than it was 20 years ago. Because we figured out how to get all these people past cancer and heart disease that used to take them out, which means that there are more people in their 80s now, but it's actually a much less healthy population because maybe, those people who had cancer and heart disease, these things are all connected, were probably doing a worse job of aging than these other people were. So it's a scientifically established fact that certain people have the right genetic mix to just keep on going. That's why I think that 75 cutoff from Zeke Emanuel is way too high. Sorry, is way too early.
Low.
Way too low, because there are people who have lived to be 120. There are multiple people. I think there's only one person who's lived to be 120. There are 10, 15 people who have lived to be 116 or more. By the time they get it to 116, they are all more or less vegetative. I mean, you know, they can, some of them can talk, some of them can walk. But those people who are at 116 are people who were living pretty happy, pretty healthy, pretty solid lives in their hundreds. Yeah. Some of them living independently in their hundreds. So they are sort of, they sort of indicate to all of us that actually the potential of the human body quite a bit larger than, oh, you're going to just have to be miserable in your 70s and 80s. And what I find really interesting about the Peter Attia book, the Outlive book, is he's like, okay, so I've begun to give up on a lot of these. You know, this is a man who's turned 50. He's like, a lot of these, you know, answers, these drugs, these, I'm just going to starve myself enough. All, a lot of these solutions that were supposed to get me to 150 are seeming less likely to me now. But there are interventions I can make that make it much more likely, that improve the odds that I can have a really good time in my 80s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, relatively healthy up until your 80s, say. And I think there's the Mediterranean diet's touted as being very beneficial.
Yeah, well, the Mediterranean diet has been touted for decades, though I saw something recently that it was like, there was some kind of like selection bias or something along those lines, where it was actually...
Because there's a Spanish trial they talked about with, 7,447 subjects that is supposed to do 6 years, but apparently it was apparent that the... So there's one group, high-fat Mediterranean diet, that had to take a liter of olive oil a week. When you first hear it, you think they're chugging it, but obviously they're adding it to their food. High-fat Mediterranean diet, but with a lot of nuts to make up the fat, and then low-fat Mediterranean diet. And the ones on the low-fat did very badly. So it does seem to be olive oil and nuts, but obviously that's just one trial. And food trials are famously difficult to do because people might say they're doing what they're supposed to and then they're not. So things like that.
I think there was some... I saw a very critical... I haven't done research on this, but I did see a very critical quick take that it was something along the lines of sort of a lot of these documented places with very high longevity might have something to do with tax dodging. Like, people are just sort of pretending that their relatives are still alive.
Well, I remember there was a famous one in Japan where there was like one of the most, either the oldest person in that province, and they were going to, like, you know, the government was going to, you know, surprise them and give them an award, only to find out that they had mummified in their bath and the relatives were pretending they were still alive to collect the pension. So, but yeah, Japan and Italy, I think, are the two big ones that seem to have a lot of very old people.
Yes, yes. I don't think it's all a fraud, but
no, they're not all mummified in their baths.
So what, unfortunately, Atiyah's prescription is essentially you need to eat better and you need to work out more, which is not...
All the boring stuff you've been told to do all your life. There's some stuff with flossing. There's an idea that the bacteria is found a lot in people with dementia. Saunas apparently are good. But yeah, a lot of the stuff, what do you call it? A lot of fish, omega-3 fatty acids, stuff like that. But yes, a lot of stuff we've heard that's like, yeah, you should get some muscle mass because falling over is really bad when you're old. So the more you have, the better.
Yeah.
Be active, do sports, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
All the things you don't want to do.
I read these things in fairly quick succession, this concept like our population of 80-somethings is less healthy than, you know, it's ever been because there's so many more of them. And then just this sort of Atiyah focus on, you know, physical, what have you. And they jive together rather nicely. And it's just like, if a broader section of people were thinking along these lines, we'd have a healthier section of 80-somethings. I still believe that we will have, by the time you or I are in our 70s, 3 decades from now, we should have some serious interventions that are not going to take us to...
1,000.
Our 200s. but could actually make our 90s or our 100s, you know, rather pleasant. Because if you actually, you know, it's physically demonstrated that human beings can make it to 120. You know, if we had a world where most people worked happily and you know, in a way that they can contribute into their 80s and then lived for another 20 years of retirement, that would be a pretty, and happily so, that would be a pretty amazing world. And I think it's something that we could actually get to.
Well, there's some good news on aging. Well, this, you know, from the UK was 60-year-olds are roughly 10 years, you know, physically younger than they were, say, 40 years ago. So it could be to do with...
I wonder how they demonstrate that.
Well, I think it's just what they're able to do in their muscle mass and stuff and other diseases they're liable to. So retirees are, you know, in a better form to live longer, while quite often you get to retirement and then die.
Yep.
While I think smoking and drinking are going to be the big ones. They've dramatically taken a nosedive, and I know vaping gets a lot of criticism lately, but it does seem to be significantly better than smoking.
What I found most interesting, I think what Peter Attia's great contribution is going to be conceptually, is just this idea of setting your baseline, essentially saying, like, what do you want to be able to do in your 80s and 90s? Can you do it now? And the baseline you're setting is, in fact, whatever you want to do in your, say, if you want to be able to go on a 3-mile hike in your 80s, you'd better be able to go on a 15-mile hike today. Seems obvious, but I think it's much more interesting and helpful than, well, you should work out more and you should eat more, but actually just sort of thinking, like, what does 80-year-old Rob want to be able to do? Can 40-something Rob do that? And is he able to do enough more? And is he setting the stage for that to be possible? And it's I don't know, I found that to be a very useful approach, a very useful way of looking at
it. But I think a big one is sleep. It says 6 to 9 hours. I've noticed that definitely if I get 8 hours, it's almost like you're on some sort of wonder drug. While sadly at the moment I'm getting around 7, which is still decent, but you know, I could do better.
Yeah. We could all stand to get more sleep. But I just want to say, like, I think thus far I've seemed rather jaded. And I honestly think one of the most jaded things about Peter Attia is, like, for 20 years I've been looking at this. The one thing that has been known more than anything else, you can definitely extend your life if you just starve yourself. It's called caloric restriction, and it's apparently been demonstrated. So there's a lot of trials that have managed to make flies live longer, worms live longer, mice. That's a little more interesting, making mice live longer. I think there have been at least one or two studies that have shown that if you restrict monkeys for their lifetime to 30% less food, they do live longer and healthier.
So I think the issue is the difference between, like, fasting. You know, some people seem to take it to the extremes. But I think what it means is some people are just constantly eating. And the theory is that your organs are only supposed to work for so many hours a day and then kind of just rest. But if you're constantly working them, you're more likely to give issue to them. So it's possible, rather than a fasting diet, just a sort of more, you know, these are the hours you eat and don't eat after these hours and don't go crazy. Just eat, like, normal amounts, which, when there's so many tasty, delicious things everywhere, it's hard to do.
Well, this is all very open and very undetermined science. But what was interesting is my first exposure to Peter Attia was actually a series about living longer that was put together by Thor. You know, or it was at least run by the guy, the Australian actor.
Okay.
Or something like that. And what was interesting is that in this television program from 3 or 4 years ago or what have you, Peter Attia was the guy who guided Hemsworth, that's his name, Hemsworth, through a fast.
Look, I'm going to do it with you.
You are?
Yeah. It makes it a lot easier to go through this with somebody else. So.
Okay, good. Good. We'll suffer together.
We will.
It was like, because you just need to not eat for 2 or 3 days, and that's going to be this amazing...
Because I think they are quite brutal to those Marvel actors to get them in that shape.
Indeed. This was a different series where it was like a Discovery Channel or National Geographic. Like, it was like a, this is how I meet my limits or whatever, or something like that. And what was interesting is that Peter Attia was the doctor who, like, came on to say that fasting is the way to do it. You should do this a couple times a year, blah, blah, blah. Yet in the book, he's kind of like, meh, actually, I'm not sure about that, which was very interesting.
Well, I think the more evidence has come out that it can, you know, not annoy people, it can be bad for you. People take it too far, but also for diet-wise, it can just really annoy people. Because it's like, oh, I've been starving myself, and then they just unleash onto the world of food again. And also, they do the thing where it's like, oh, well, I fasted yesterday, so I can, you know, eat whatever I want today. So it can have very mixed results. But yes, it does seem to be a pulling back on the fasting ideals.
One thing I want to sort of touch on is that there's sort of the history of this longevity. So basically, for every 2 or 3 years, there's like a burst. I was throwing out a bunch of Bloomberg and Economist magazines, and I noticed that last year, both of them came out with a longevity cover issue. But for at least 20 years now, we've been talking about like, oh, we're going to make these great strides. About in the 2000s, when the tech moguls first started getting rich, they set aside a lot of money for life extension. I think it's Calico, the Google founders, put together. California Life Extension Company. Anyway, whatever. It is like they've put billions, maybe not billions, but they put a lot of money. Like Amazon's got his thing, Elon Musk has got his thing, the Google guys have got their thing. They've been pouring all this money into it, and I think it's with the Peter Attia book, you can see a real sense of fatigue because it's like, and this really hasn't yielded much.
And also, I take it there's also a selfishness. These billionaires want this medication for themselves so they can live to 200.
Oh, hell yeah. But if they come up with the answers, we all get the answers, you know?
The fact that there's, you know, silly amounts of money being thrown at this and there hasn't really been any miracle cures other than sleep better. Well, one interesting thing he was pointing out was stability. It's one of those things where it's almost like his mind's now flipped completely the other way and he's looking at the evidence. He's basically saying when you're, you know, in your 70s and you fall, it's really bad for you. So he's saying if you have a certain level of health and muscle mass and you're stable, you're less likely to fall and then you're not going to hit that, you know, massive decline of health.
If
you were to tell someone in, you know, 40 years in the past that, you know, the important thing is to make sure you have a decent muscle mass, they'll say, oh, you're in the future. Do you know some magical cures?
Nope. You just need to lift more. Which is interesting, just living, I don't know if this is just a New York thing or everybody is into lifting now, which is fascinating. It is a huge, because it's
relatively simple.
I have avoided lifting my entire life because I've always been big enough, as was sort of my thinking. But I've gotten into it recently over the past, really just the past 4 or 5 months, and it is revelatory. Like I thought I was never going to be able to run long distances without pain again, but because I've been doing working with a trainer a little bit, like I can run again. And it's not right now. Right now my back is out, but I've been able to run much more over the past 6 months than I have been able to since my early 30s. And it is just kind of fascinating watching these sort of cultural shifts. And this book, Outlive by Peter Attia, is more successful than... it just random people are bringing it up to me in my social networks. I think it's being widely read. And I think it might have something to do with the fact that everybody's sort of lifting now. But I do want to say that despite the amount of money that's been poured into this, despite the lack of success, I am still quite optimistic because of the baby boomers. I said this as a short quite some time ago. I think that famously, I think... egregious baby boomer hatred is perhaps overdone, but it would not be unfair to point out that selfishness is a part of the baby boomer makeup as a generation. Speaking broadly, and it is also an incredibly wealthy generation, and I think an extraordinary amount of money is going to be spent on figuring out how to live longer. And I think that, I mean, this has been a factor since the baby boomers were, you know, in their 30s and 40s, and yoga and running became a big thing in the 70s and 80s. I think an extraordinary amount of this wealth is going to get poured into figuring things out. And I do think that as we get not, you know, people thought the human genome would be sequenced, and then 3 years later,
yes.
3 years later, we're curing everything. But as we get to 30, 40 years after the sequencing of the human genome, as we figure out more and more strange things to do in terms of gene therapies, as we discover, you know, we actually already have a miracle cure for aging out there. It's called rapamycin.
Okay.
And I think Diamandis talked
about
it in
that.
His book. Yeah. And it's a miracle cure for aging, but you know, if you don't take it right, it kills you. So
is this the medicine that's given for so you don't reject organs?
Yes, exactly. So there have been compounds that have been identified. Like I take a bunch of supplements, like you know, red wine pills or whatever. There's metformin, which is generally for diabetes, that is in a large scale trial. There is rapamycin, which they haven't figured out a way to safely administer that to people. And, you know, like these compounds are not going to help people live forever. But I do think that there's going to be so much money poured into figuring out how to safely deliver and effectively deliver those, that by the time we are in our 60s, I think that we're all going to be taking, you know, metformin or rapamycin in pill form that, you know, could very plausibly mean that if we do make it into our 90s, those 90s are not going to be miserable vegetable stuff.
Yes.
The miserable vegetable stuff will start in our, you know, our late 90s or something like that, which would be
our 120s.
One never knows. So there's this concept of, they call it longevity escape velocity. Which is a fascinating concept based on a lot of incredibly dubious math.
From DeGray, is this?
I'm not sure if that's a DeGray concept initially,
okay.
But it could be. It could be. So the longevity escape velocity is this idea that, well, the past century of medical progress has been extraordinary, and we've gotten to the point where actually we've added 3 months to life expectancy every year. So, and that could continue to grow. And if you just get to live, if you just stay healthy enough to live long enough to the point where the life expectancy is growing by a year every year, you've reached escape velocity and you can live forever. That's longevity escape
yes.
velocity, which...
I think there's a lot of issues with that.
Yeah, which is, we will start unpacking those now, which is something that you know, I was never like, yes, of course, this is happening. But I was like, oh, I found that a very intriguing concept in my 20s, because back in my 20s, that was still a world we lived in before U.S. life expectancy started plateauing and falling.
But it's going up in other countries.
Yes.
You could just move to Canada. You'll be all right.
One of the most fundamental lies of the life extension industry is this idea that, oh, my God, look at how much life lifespan has expanded. And it's actually like it can really filter into a lot of writing where people will be like, well, back in the Roman times, everybody died before they were 40. It's like, that's actually not how the math works here, buddy. It is absolutely true that across aggregate populations, the increase in lifespan has been, over the past century, has been extraordinary. It has been extraordinarily positive as well, because what it has meant is what it has mostly been has been the fall in infant mortality. Like, we have figured out how to get most babies to be delivered alive and have most women survive the process. And that is an extraordinary accomplishment. And that has dramatically changed the math. What matters is life expectancy at 5. Or something. So like, how long could a 5-year-old expect to live? Now, that actually is significantly higher, but it's like 20 years higher in 2024 than it was in 1924, not like 50 years higher or something like that. Or maybe it's only 10 years, which is also like an incredible accomplishment. But like, people like are like, yeah, so everyone in the 1840s died at 50. And it's like, no, man, that's not actually.
But also things that are completely outside of the scope of this is the fact like factories are significantly safer. Modes of transport are safer. Like, who's riding about on horses, which are just incredibly dangerous creatures? There's so many things like lead's not in the air. There's so many things that are outside of the medical world that just means a lot of humans are kind of they're not having these other externalities pressed upon them that make them iller?
Well, the greatest contribution to life extension over the past 30 years is 100% smoking cessation. I am somebody who, I think people are rightly bothered by the fact that cigarette smoking and vapes are still as large as they are. But I am definitely somebody, and somebody who was very angry about these law changes from a libertarian perspective in my 20s. Like, but I am somebody who would absolutely still be a pack-a-day smoker if it was possible. You know, it's just, you just can't anymore. There's no office place where you can smoke. There's no, and it is socially, it is.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you're a pariah.
Socially looked down on incredibly. Like, I do still occasionally smoke a cigar now and again. The fact that I smelled a little bit like a cigar after, like, you know, has played the role in, like, a role in, like, the demise of relationships I've had recently. You know, like, there's a real stigma. I mean, that was not a relationship that's going to survive anyway. But, you know, it played a role. Like, and it's like, I'm going to live a lot longer because it's no longer socially acceptable to smoke cigarettes all the fucking time. And that's, you know, that's a huge intervention. That is not sci-fi. That is not.
Oh, yeah.
you know, you're gonna live forever. But
because just for a bit of context, Leonidas of 300 fame was in his 60s when he died in that battle.
Oh, well,
so,
there you
know,
go.
Living to, you know, at least your 60s, 2000 years ago was common enough.
it was something that happened. And yes. I think that people can get sort of a little tripped up by math, by confusing sort of population aggregates with what an individual. So that's the sort of fundamental misconception that I unfortunately have seen some advocates engage in, that, like, well, gosh, you know, if we've gone from 40 years to 70 years, why can't we go from 70 years to 120 years? And I think we absolutely can, but it might take, you know, it might take another 200 years for us to get there.
Because I know there's this idea that most life forms are meant to, like, live a certain period, pass on their genes, and then die because it's better for the next generation. So there's a theory that we have, like, a built-in, like, self-destruct. And that's why quite often is it, you know, 65, 70, things tend to taper off quite quickly. So it's possible that at some sort of gene level, if you're going to turn that off and then just say, oh, yeah, you're 20, and the body just continues forever. And then at that point, you have sort of beaten aging. So this is sort of like a magical cure almost. But you hear a lot, it's very nuclear fusion.
but I think nuclear fusion will eventually happen. It just might take, you know, 200 years rather than. I mean, the thing that seems pretty obvious to me, and I have seen zero of these advocates talk about it, is that, yes, actually, I think that the first person who to live to 1,000 could totally be born this century, but it's nobody who's alive now. Because it seems obvious to me from what little we know from Dolly and you know, stuff, is that what you need to do is you need to set all these markers and clocks and whatnot genetically, you know, as an embryo. Like, you can set this stuff so we can, you know, within the next couple decades, we'll be able to engineer children with super centenarian genes. So, like, there'll be a bit of engineering that we'll be able to do guaranteeing that every child can live to 120, or has the potential to live to 120, whereas very few, you know, vanishingly rare humans have even that potential today. We can get that potential to everybody, but you're going to have to do that with the genes.
Before you're born.
Yeah, and if somebody in 2050 is guaranteed 120 years, then, you know, they've made it to 2170, and by that point, I think it's entirely possible that longevity escape velocity will have been reached. But nobody who's been born without genetic engineering that does not quite yet exist is going to be living past 100, you know, significantly past 120.
It's the same issue I think you have at the other end with cryo, which is a lot of it's based around, there's like a frog that you can freeze and then unfreeze and it's back to normal as if nothing happened. But the issue is that that frog didn't die. It's naturally meant that it can freeze. So the problem is with cryogenics is they wait till the person's dead and then they freeze them, and the idea is like, something in the future might be able to fix this. But I feel like if they're already dead, it's too late. You need to sort of put the human body in a sort of suspended animation, as they talk about in the sci-fi. So you're still technically alive. You're just, you know, in like an extreme hibernation, and then you're woken out of it. So you haven't died, essentially, which I think's the main issue. It's like, yeah, you're dead. You can't cure death.
Yeah, I've just never had any interest in the sort of cryo, and I find it's very similar to the, well, I'm just going to scan my brain and then put it into a computer, and I'm like, well, that seems like a gross copy. Yeah, like I don't really. Yeah,
you are a sort of biological entity. Just yeah, a copy of it is sort of meaningless.
Yeah, it's never really appealed. There's this great. I think I'm sure it was done before him, but I first became aware of it in a great comic book, Warren Ellis's Transmetropolitan. And it was just sort of this joke, is that they figured it out. Like, they figured out cryogenics. All these frozen people came back. It's like two centuries from now or whatnot. But they came into a world that's so vastly different. And whatever wealth they had saved away had disappeared in financial crises. So they instantly became... The unfrozen people instantly became insane homeless people. Like that was your new life in the future, even if you were fabulously wealthy 200 years ago, was you instantly came to, and your brain was broken by whatever.
Just how different things are.
How different things are, and you have no resources, so you just become a weird street person.
It's a bit like the opposite of the Star Trek episode where they find cryogenically frozen people, where one of the guys is like, so what's happened to my oil stocks? And they're like, oh, well, we have all the resources we need. We don't need money. And he's like really angry. The concept of money is gone.
Yeah. Well, Warren Ellis, I think pre-cancellation was a pretty, always had a pretty dark approach to things. So, but yeah, so cryogenics has never really, it's the continuity that has always appealed to me.
So what have you implemented into your life apart from lifting?
I do occasionally do some intermittent fasting. I had really terrible, terrible heartburn in my 30s. I'd gotten endoscopies. I was on prescription Prilosec. And then I started doing 36-hour fasts, which I don't do at all consistently, but I did consistently like every week or so for a year or so. And I cured it entirely. So
wow, that's incredible.
I take a bunch of supplements that I don't really put much credence in. But no, I mean the main thing that I'm trying to do at this point, and sort of the project of my 40s, is get back to my college high school weight and stay there. And I think I was in my 260s for most of 2023, and I'm in my 250s for most of 2024. And let's see. See if I can get in consistently into my 240s in the next year. But yeah, I think for sure I need to lose weight and get to, as Peter Attia points out, like a sustainable level of fitness preservation, like a base. And then as far as that, it's just really basic stuff like, you know, working on my sleep, working on stuff like that. And
well, I think a big one he points out is just try to have no distraction in the room that you sleep in.
Yeah.
It has to be sort of as boring as possible. So as soon as your brain goes in it, it goes, sleep, that's all I do here. Mm-hmm. So yeah, try not to look at phones and stuff like that. Exercise, another one he recommends. Ketos, which is a bit fasting-y, but you know, basically sugar is the enemy. Omega-3s, flossing, sauna, vitamin B, vitamin D, grip strength he talks about. Apparently there's a correlation between grip strength and brain health, which I thought was interesting.
That is fascinating.
But it could be just like a part of overall fitness. And sleeping between 6 to 9 hours a day. Because some people are different.
So I think I am more optimistic than Peter Attia is, in part perhaps because I have not been in the trenches trying to figure this stuff out. But like it is... clear to me from what little I know about the history of science is just how all of this is just an accident. And at some point, the billions of dollars that Jeff Bezos and the Google people have poured in, the trillions, literally trillions of dollars that the baby boomers will pour into this field over the next couple decades, will find something wacky, something ridiculous that just works. And it's not going to, by works, it doesn't mean we're all going to live forever. It means that we're all probably going to have another functional decade or two. And our grandchildren could potentially live for the kinds of, you know, centuries-long periods that are being promised by the less scrupulous advocates of this field.
But I always wonder, like, as a sort of thought experiment, if I could give you, like, immortality, but it's only for sickness and aging, like, would you ever leave the house?
What do you mean?
Because there's an idea that, like, well, you could die of a heart attack right now, or if you leave, you could get run over by a bus. So you sort of weigh up the fact that, well, if I do nothing, I might die, so I might as well try to live my life to the fullest, even though it does, you know, increase my likelihood. But if you could be, you know, immortal, but only from, like, you know, illness and aging, but, you know, gunshots and being run over can still kill you, would you then become super paranoid and try to live in, like, a super safe cocoon, or...
That is a fascinating question. I hadn't really thought about that. Because, I mean, I'm going through something like that right now, whereas I'm just sort of like, okay, I'm getting a little more serious about my health. Like, how much bicycling in New York City do I want to do? Because I have, through my 20s and 30s, I have been quite reckless and quite happy to. I've always worn a helmet, but my sort of thinking was like, well, I'm wearing a helmet, so, like,
you're invincible.
I can do whatever the fuck I want, which is not a good. And for the first time, I got in two rather serious accidents within a week of each other last October, and I was just sort of like, oh, like, and it really sort of gave me pause. And yeah, if I thought I had hundreds of years to live, like, would I so eagerly dive? Because my intention is, like, I want to get over it and I want to dive back into New York City biking, perhaps with a little more of a sense of safety. But that is a really interesting question. Like, if they really did cure all these aging issues, then would we reach, as a society, would we just become overly cautious? I think that is not a argument I've heard before, and that is a fascinating thing to think about.
The other issue is, a lot of what plagues, you know, planet Earth is mostly, like, hunger and safety. So should we be wasting this money worrying about, you know, incredibly rich 90-year-olds when we know what most people need? Like, you know, could the UN pass a bill stating that everyone should get a ration of so much food? You know, obviously maybe richer countries don't get this, but, you know, there's a lot more that is very cheap that could help millions of people when we're sort of worried about a very small minority of incredibly wealthy people.
Well, I think absolutely that's true. But also, I think that worrying about a minority of wealthy people is how most things have gotten cured. The great example would be HIV, in part because it did hit a disproportionately affluent and professionally successful group of people in the United States, many gay men. There was a tremendous amount of effort and money poured into making HIV a very survivable, manageable illness. And if it had not been for that investment in the 80s and 90s and the aughts, half of Africa would be dead by now. So it is, I mean, absolutely, there are great injustice is possible here. I think of another, Altered Carbon.
Okay.
They made a Netflix series out of it recently that makes puts a lot of thought into, like, well, what would immortality mean? It would obviously be monopolized by a bunch of oligarchs. You know, what would this look like 500 years later? It's a very interesting set of thought experiments. And I think that's definitely worth thinking about and meditating upon. But if I look at how medical advances have been disseminated over the course of the 20th century, it's always rich people first, and then the rest do benefit. A great example would be statins, which actually are kind of a life extension drug. You're familiar with statins? So statins essentially lower a person's cholesterol. And I think that this can be credited to the fact that my father and his two brothers are, I think, my father is turning 82 this year. His two brothers are not too far behind him in their late 70s or early 80s. It used to be that all Morris men died by 75 of a heart attack. That's just what happened. All these three guys have been taking statins for a number of years. I take statins now as a 40-something with high cholesterol. This miracle drug that is basically reducing heart disease across wide populations now costs like, it's like $250 a month or something like that, even in the United States.
Yes.
Even in the United States. But when it was introduced, 30, 40 years ago, it was extraordinarily expensive. But that's, you know, that's how these things get trotted out. I think absolutely that can be used as an argument for our nightmarishly bad healthcare system in general. And I would never want to do that. I think that actually it would be to resolve the injustices of the U.S. healthcare system, it would be worth missing another couple decades of medical innovation, frankly. But as far as like a broad-based argument against life extension technologies and research, I don't buy it.
Okay. So the More Freedom Foundation would recommend that you get plenty of sleep.
Indeed. Do some lifting.
So you can keep listening to us into the many centuries to come.
Indeed. Indeed. Indeed.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.